Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes David Linden, Johns Hopkins Professor of Neuroscience and editor of Think Tank, a cutting-edge collection of essays exploring the quirky and counterintuitive aspects of the brain. Linden will be joined by colleagues Dr. Connor and Dr. Bastian. Wednesday, April 25th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop at 6080 Falls Road. For more information, call 410-377-2966 or go to theivybookshop.com. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.
Good day from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 376. 376 episodes so far. Wow. For Thursday, April 19th, 2018. On the show today, evangelicals and Donald Trump. How the Christian right has made a deal to overlook a lot of issues related to Trump's character and to support him, no matter what. No matter porn star, playmate, nasty tweets, or arguably anti-Christian tax cuts for the rich. According to Newsweek, a new poll suggests that Trump's base of white evangelical support has not been hurt at all by his lawyer's hush money to Stormy Daniels, nor by the allegations that Trump had a year-long affair with a former Playboy bunny shortly after his wife Melania gave birth to their son Barron. Au contraire, as reports of the president's infidelities and shady business deals have piled up, says Newsweek, white evangelical Protestants have only come to hold more favorable attitudes about the guy. In October, 73% of white evangelicals supported Trump. Now, according to a new poll from the Public Religion Research Institute, support has risen a couple of percentage points to 75%. Why? And is this hypocritical? Joining me today for this discussion about conservative Christians seeing Trump as their man no matter what, our American culture commentator Sherry Parks and political analyst Melissa Deckman. I saw a tweet the other day from Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, lauding Donald Trump for being a pious, prayerful man, and saying that he was praying for Donald Trump.
I pray for the president, and I'm proud that he's our president and that he solicits prayer, wants it, and understands it. It's refreshing to have someone like that in power.
And I know he said other nice things about Donald Trump being a religious man.
Well, you know, the president has not been ashamed of the name of Jesus Christ. He hasn't been ashamed of his faith. And that's refreshing. He doesn't mind pastors like myself mentioning the name of Jesus Christ. And President Trump, some people question his faith. I'm not going to question his faith. He says he's a Christian, so I have to believe him and trust him. But he is, a man who does want God's help. And he wants God's help, not only in the presidency, but as he deals with all the world problems and problems here at home, he wants God's help.
And I've read some other evangelicals who've said this, and I'm just kind of amazed by that, given all that's happened, all that's been revealed either during the campaign or since then, especially when it comes to how he's treated women and how he's behaved. This is also counterintuitive to me, and you look at polling, Melissa, you have... There's a new poll out being reported by Newsweek today that shows like 75% support among evangelicals.
Among white evangelicals.
Among white evangelicals.
It is kind of head-scratching, I think. I would say a couple things. One, I think that white evangelicals are not entirely monolithic, and there are certainly evangelicals out there who have been consistently opposed to Donald Trump because of his background, because of his immoral acts and his personal life. And so there is a voice of criticism there. The problem, though, is when you have someone who's as notable as Franklin Graham, who has a big following, or someone like Tony Perkins from the Family Research Council, which is a leading Christian right organization, who says the president deserves a mulligan for having had an affair with a porn star. Those voices tend to rise to the top, and they're obviously quite hypocritical at best. It's one thing to, I think, be more transactional, to recognize that Trump is a flawed person, but many evangelical leaders have been happy with Trump in terms of his policies and his procedures. So he's appointed pro-life judges. He's walked back some transgender rights. He moved the capital of Israel to Jerusalem. All of these issues are really important to many Christian right leaders. And so I think there has been a willingness to support Trump because of the actions he's had in office. I think what's harder to swallow is when you have evangelical leaders like Franklin Graham who are saying that somehow he's personally, while in office, become more pious and he's a man of faith. I think that's harder to reconcile with a lot of people. And so for many people who look at this devout support, this unwavering support among white evangelicals, I think something like 78% of them say he's doing a good job. That's where the disconnect comes in for people who aren't necessarily affiliated with the movement.
It's really interesting to go back a little bit with the idea of the mulligan, because I've been thinking about the idea of Christian forgiveness, and I'm not sure that I've ever heard a doctrine that talks about forgiveness if you've never repented and you keep doing it.
Yes, doesn't there have to be some sincerity there? I'm sincerely sorry.
Right, and I mean, and certainly I've heard, certainly in Protestant circles, that you know you're already forgiven, but you know when you can not confess, but because they don't have confession in that way, but that God has already forgiven you before you know it. But this idea of a mulligan suggests you get to do it over and over and over again, and then it's a do-over. Yeah. It's a golf term, and so it's really kind of interesting. There's this whole new aspect of I really think that the religious leaders are covering themselves so that they can praise Trump and still have their authority, because they have to say, well, no, he's really a good man. Really, I've conceptualized this mulligan aspect, you know,
because they get what they want.
Exactly.
As Melissa just described.
Well, I mean, it reminds me of, there have been other times in American history where expedience was more important than the moral high ground. And this is an expedient moment. One of the things about the New York Times article that you mentioned, it described how the evangelical right, the white evangelical right, has gotten smaller and smaller. And we still see that in the Newsweek article that Melissa identified, is that only 8% of their membership is under 30. So you're getting a smaller, more isolated, more to the right, more male group of people. It's that angry white male aspect that we've been talking about for a long time. And Trump is their guy. And so we certainly see this in political behavior as a type of consumer behavior, unfortunately, where, I mean, you buy the thing and then you make up a rationale for why you buy it.
I agree completely with Sherry. There's a lot of what I would call post hoc theological rationalization going on. And I also agree with Sherry, too, that a lot of these religious figures have to sort of justify, you know, why they're still backing this guy, given his personal behavior that is just entirely repugnant. But, you know, a lot of the people in their pews are big Trump backers, frankly, and so that they have to kind of recognize that a lot of the people that are sitting in their pews are supportive. But getting back to this post hoc theological rationalization, all of a sudden, for example, I see lots of stories on Christian right websites about King David. You know, King David was flawed. He had a man killed on the battlefront so he could marry Bathsheba, right? So mm-hmm. There's like pointing to this, like, and still, God used King David for good ends. And that's kind of what you get a lot of these Christian right leaders saying. Well, Trump, of course, is flawed. We're all flawed. God forgives us. But he can still be used for good ends. You know, the ends justifies the means, which is really, frankly, a very unchristian, I would say, argument, but nonetheless, one that you hear a lot in some circles among evangelical leaders.
Well, and if you tie that with his very apparent lack of knowledge of scripture, any scripture, then what does that make him? I'm not suggesting that anybody who is perceived as an instrument of God is what we would call a dumb instrument in computer science. But that suggests that he is. He doesn't know the scripture. He doesn't understand it. He's not living the life. And yet God uses him, makes him basically this instrument, this tool.
Mm-hmm. In the minds of these evangelicals. I want to go back to forgiveness for a moment. This idea that we're all sinners. Yeah, okay, I'll accept that, but you have to ask for forgiveness. There has to be, I used the word sincerity before. You don't get any of that from Trump. remember Jimmy Carter, President Carter's deep inner thoughts that he shared in public, I think in a Playboy magazine interview.
Lusting in his heart.
But, you know, he was a religious man, deeply steeped in his faith, and talked a lot about, you know, forgiveness and being a sinner and hoping to find redemption someplace, you know. That's not part of Trump's vocabulary at all.
No, and in fact, during the campaign, during the presidential campaign, he was asked point blank whether he'd ask God for forgiveness. He's like, I don't really have anything to ask for forgiveness for. That really was his response. So, wow. Which is just mind-boggling to think, you know, that evangelical leaders feel the need. Many on the right, at least, feel the need to sort of justify, you know, and claim that he's had this spiritual growth while in office. And clearly, his behavior has not changed at all. He still lies with impunity. You know, he still uses tweets to malign people and to call them names, and is passing policies socially that might be conservative, but in terms of, if you think about the Beatitudes and the gospel message, you know, passing huge tax cuts for the wealthiest people is not exactly what I would call a Christian sort of doctrine.
Yeah, and treatment of the least of these is not what's going on. Yeah.
Connie Morella served in Congress from Maryland for 8 terms. She was a Republican from Montgomery County. She was on the show last week, and she used that term tribalism. So I go to this term now because I think when you look at Trump's 40% approval rating that seems to be unchanged, right? It's not dropping. It's not getting much better either, but it's around that 40% mark pretty solidly. I think maybe we are at a place where this is our guy, and no matter what, we're sticking with him. And if you people on the left, the Democrats don't like him, then he must be good, or something like that.
And we'll follow him into battle. If you follow that, we'll follow him into battle.
Oh, yeah.
No matter what.
If it's a tribe, yeah. What about tribalism? I mean, maybe that's another term for super partisanship.
Or nativism.
Yeah, well, that's part of that tribe's thing, right? Mm-hmm. So I was struck by that term. I said, maybe that's where we are. Maybe that's what this is about.
I would agree, Dan. I mean, as a political scientist, I can tell you we've looked a lot at growing partisan polarization in American politics, and there is a tribal aspect to that. So, in fact, you're willing to justify or overlook certain behaviors if the person has an R behind his name. I mean, a great example of this would be last December's special election in Alabama with Roy Moore. I mean, to me, I just was left speechless that Donald Trump would attend a rally in support of someone like Roy Moore, who, you know, of course, credible evidence that he had sexually assaulted minors. You know, you think to yourself, there has to be a line in the sand, right? But apparently not. And so that, to me, kind of is just the most blatant example of the problems with tribalism. But I think it's also, again, partisanship colors so much of our views in the American public. So I just wanted to give you a great example. This is one of my favorite questions that PRRI has asked in the last couple of years about personal morality. And so they've asked consistently American voters, do you think an elected official who commits an immoral act in their private life can still behave ethically in public life, right? If you asked this to white evangelicals in 2011, only 30% of white evangelicals agreed with that comment there. So for them, personal morality really counted. However, when asked during the context of the presidential campaign, 72% said that they believe that you can be immoral in your personal life and still behave ethically in public life. 42 percentage points. And so, I mean, if you ask that question during the Clinton administration, you'd have a very different answer because of the nature of our politics today.
Or Obama. The question was asked while Obama was president, right?
That was asked when Obama was president.
That's
but I think back to what
amazing.
These same leaders were saying with respect, for example, to the Lewinsky affair that President Clinton had, you know, in the late 90s.
Well, when you start comparing them to other presidents, that's why I was fascinated by the word mulligan, because during his tenure, Clinton asked for a mulligan in golf. It was written about as an indication of his moral problems.
Yes, that was a great article.
That?
I did read that.
And now we're talking about a much different mulligan, and you get it. They're giving him permission. But I really do think that this is, I mean, you brought up tribalism and nativism, that at this point, many people in that camp don't care. They're worried about the browning of America. They're worried about all of these aspects. And that type of behavior isn't necessarily rational. I mean, they are trying to preserve a certain way of life, and they don't care as long as they deliver it. There are many times, and we're talking about religiosity, but many times he says things that just aren't true. The whole comment about Nigeria and huts.
Yeah.
The Nigerians are the most highly educated immigrants, not most highly educated black immigrants, most highly educated immigrants that come to the United States. So it's just blatantly not true. And yet people follow his dictate. And I said this many, many years ago. I mean, not many, but 2015. This model really isn't about rationality. It really is about irrationality.
Yeah, because I don't know how else you explain it. It must be based on these visceral reactions people have to, as you say, more immigrants coming into the country. They're concerned about that. You know, women moving into positions of power.
Getting some.
You know, and look at the reaction to these kids in Florida on gun control. Really angry, nasty response from the right toward
survivors.
You know, survivors of a trauma. I mean, it's just amazing to me. I guess that speaks to the tribalism, too, that's out there. So David Brooks had a column in the Times last week, I think it was, saying that the resistance isn't working. You're not breaking through to people who are still supporting Trump. Look at his support among Republicans. Generally, it's still, what, Melissa, 70 or higher?
Yeah, it hasn't really budged at all.
Yeah.
It hasn't.
So he's saying, you know, that's a reelection to me in 2020. The resistance isn't working because the people who are resisting fail to recognize what's eating people who are supporting Trump, why they're supporting Trump. And I don't know that you can break through, given what we're talking about here.
And the changes that they are resisting from the right are irreversible. I mean, Latinos are having, the ones who are here, we're not talking about immigration, are younger, and they're having more babies. And so the browning of America will continue. Women are the majority in the workforce and in colleges. So that trend will continue.
Right.
So these are irreversible trends no matter what they do, and they're going to be angry about it.
You know, I think that all of these things are really true. And what was brilliant about Trump's campaign message, Make America Great Again, it was the again part, because essentially, this kind of tapped into a lot of voters' insecurities about changes in the economy that they weren't really feeling. The browning of America, as Sherry points out, women getting, I think, more leadership roles, taking over jobs than maybe that men had. And so I think that all of those things are very true. But, you know, it's a short-term gain, but in the long term, this is going to do substantial damage to the Republican Party, frankly.
In what way? Tell me what you see happening there. We just heard of another Republican congressman yesterday or this week announcing that he wasn't going to be seeking re-election, of course, Paul Ryan. So what do you see happening there, Melissa?
Essentially, the Republican Party has now become the party of Trump. And if you look at younger Americans, as Sherry's already alluded to, I mean, they are becoming far more alienated from that party. I was doing some data analysis on a survey that MTV did with PRRI that came out in late January. And it was striking because what I found is that, first of all, only about 20% of millennials believe that Trump is doing a good job. But what I also found was that young women in particular were far more likely to be animated and engaged in the political process. And so the young women who were most engaged were ones who were identifying as Democrats, who backed Hillary Clinton in the last campaign, and who prioritized gender equality. And so the backlash that Trump has caused, I think, for a lot of these groups, and when you think about political identity forming in adolescence and forming in early adulthood, I mean, it's rare that people change their parties over time. And so you have this new generation of younger, more diverse, and more progressive folks coming up. And the Republican Party is completely just, I think, alienating those voters.
They're going to run out of people. So if you look at the average age of the Trump supporter, you're talking about people who statistically are going to die, I mean, to be blunt, in the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're just going to run out of people.
Connie Morella, to quote her again, pointed out that there weren't enough women moving into position to run for office this year who are Republican. She looked at the charts that came out from the, I think it's Rutgers that keeps track of this.
Yes.
The institute at Rutgers that keeps track of the number of women who have filed papers to be candidates for Congress this year, and another in state offices, all of them. And you know, I think 2/3 are Democrats. So I said, is that because of Trump? And she said, yeah, she thinks it's because of Trump, that there's a turnoff for young women.
I don't think it's even just because of Trump. That's part of it. And in fact, it's even more lopsided than 2/3. I think it's like 70. Oh, it's almost 3-1.
Is it really?
These record-breaking number of women running, they're far more likely to be Democrats. It's also because the GOP has just not been very welcoming to women at all. So, for example, the Democratic Party prioritizes diversity, but they've also put lots of money where their mouth is, so to speak. I mean, they have got lots of candidate training. They provide seed money for women. They have candidate training schools. But there's virtually no money being spent by the Republican Party to try to encourage and recruit women to run for office at all. It just simply isn't a priority. In fact, polling data shows when you asked average American voters, do you think it's more important to have more women elected to office? Democrats, like 80%, say yes. Only about 40% of Republicans say yes. And even Republican women don't think it's more important to have more women in office. And so I think that Connie Merle is right. Like, Trump has definitely caused this surge of women on the left. But at the same time, you know, you don't necessarily have lots of Republican women saying, I should be running for office myself.
Because that runs counter to the message of the Republican religious right. I mean, there really is still a message about women being subservient and submissive. And so, I mean, the politics has always been kind of dirty, aggressive business. It's gotten dirtier and more aggressive. And that doesn't fit well with what the religious right says about women's roles.
It's also, too, though, that women who run for office, say, in primaries among the GOP, are often penalized for being women in the sense that voters think that women that run in GOP primaries tend to be more moderate as opposed to conservative. And the base right now rewards the most conservative people running for office. And so women have faced sort of a penalty, I think, there. You know, I thought it was going to go a very different route, to be perfectly honest. You know, I've always been fascinated by Sarah Palin and her impact on American politics. In fact, I wrote a book about Tea Party women. And it looked, at least for a brief time, that you had a surge of interest among Republican women who were willing to put their hats in the ring to be more involved in politics. But with this administration, with Trump, that seems to have died down dramatically, really.
Palin was a difficult model to follow. I mean, with her Alaska big game hunting aspect, I mean, there was a type of masculinization of her image.
Oh, absolutely.
Interesting perception of her. Yeah, that's true. There's a long list of things that people in the Trump base, that 40% or 39% that's holding, are willing to overlook. It's a long list. We mentioned several of them here today in this context of morality, right? But also policy issues, or possible policy issues. His approach toward Russia, for instance, you know, pulling sanctions the other day against Russian companies that have been found to collude with Syria on chemical weapons productions, right? Something like that is pretty serious stuff. And also the whole question of, was there collusion in the between the Trump campaign and Russian operatives to help him get elected? The people on the right seem to be dismissive of that. Now I'm hearing more and more criticism of James Comey, who's on a book tour now, talking about his relationship with Trump. And I find this really counterintuitive. I just want to share this with you for a moment. The most conservative people are pro-cop, Blue Lives Matter people, right? I get mail from them, and I hear them on talk radio all the time. So they seem to be pro-law enforcement, pro-law and order. And they're not even entertaining the question of whether Trump obstructed justice, the Trump campaign colluded with a rival power to win an election. So dismissive of that. I'm struck by that. I still find it somewhat amazing in the time when so many things are amazing. I just find that particular thing amazing. Lack of respect for people who have been career in law enforcement, either as prosecutors or as investigators, FBI agents. Look at how the FBI is being criticized.
You know, Dan, though, you have to also consider where they're getting their news and information.
Absolutely.
Most of these people are watching Fox News, and Fox News paint stories in such a way that essentially minimize or accuse, you know, the FBI. I did watch Sean Hannity the other night, because I do watch Fox News just to kind of get a gauge of what is being said and the messages that are being sent. And it's usually lots of immigrants who are committing crimes. Right? That's kind of the drumbeat. But they've taken, you know, especially Sean Hannity has taken to really maligning even someone who's almost universally respected, someone like Robert Mueller. At one point, he had like a diagram basically saying the Mueller crime family, right? Basically saying he was colluding with Clinton and all this other nonsense, which there's no, of course, verifiable fact. But, I mean, studies show that people on the far right, that's all they listen to Fox, they listen to Rush Limbaugh, they're reading websites that allow them to live in echo chambers where they're only hearing one perspective of things. And so this has allowed them to really minimize and to call into question as fake news what these special counsels and other investigations are doing. So they just don't believe it because they've been primed not to believe it by people on the far right.
And I agree with that. I think we're also at the maybe not the end, but certainly on a continuum, because if you think about this transition from traditional Christianity to what we have now, the electronic church plays a role. So that most of those electronic pastors were on the right. Fundamentalism became the term.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of getting your religion from the TV, it was really an aspect. And so one of the things that has been suggested is that Fox News has replaced Christian doctrine in the emotional lives of the faithful. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of getting it straight from the TV, even when it's not a pastor, I think that was a 20-year continuum, but you can begin to see people giving, I mean, you have to talk about faith when you're talking about reporting that flies in the face of mainstream media.
There's evidence that what you're saying is completely true. Just last week or the week before, Politico came out with an analysis of news subscriptions in areas where Trump did better than Romney. Did you see that, Melissa?
I have not, I want to hear what they found.
This is fascinating. So they found actually news deserts, what they called news deserts, where there was a low news subscription rate, meaning people read newspapers or subscribed to some sort of digital bona fide news service, you know, like Reuters or Yahoo News or something like that. The New York Times, Washington Post, or their local newspaper. And it's very low in places where Trump performed better than Romney in the 2016 mm-hmm. election. So you're right. So what fills that gap? It's what's on the television, right? And a lot of times it's Fox News. What we're saying then, basically, at this juncture in 2018, as we're headed into the midterms in a few months, is it maybe nothing can break through to that supportive base of Trump. It sounds like that's what we're saying, and not just among evangelicals.
In some respects, but I think there's two other points, though, that I would say. One is that I think the economy is doing fairly well, sort of inexplicably in some ways. When you look at some, like the stock market, it's just head-scratching as to why these companies are overvalued and that sort of thing. So I think, you know, we are political junkies, and we're inundated, and we read this stuff all the time, and a lot of Americans simply don't. They kind of tune out, and they think, well, things are okay for me. He's not really doing it. The president maybe isn't necessarily doing as bad of a job. I think if the economy tanks in the next couple of years, there'll be more pressure, I think, and you'll see some loss of support. I think the other thing, too, and what I've been finding interesting, is with this news about Michael Cohen, and we're going to learn a lot more about Trump's business dealings, I have a feeling, maybe the unsavory aspects of that. And so I suspect that might turn some people away from Donald Trump, but not all of them. I mean, they've been willing to stick it out this far, giving all of this other information. I mean, I think some people would say, well, look, with Donald Trump, that was sort of baked in the cake. We kind of knew he was unfaithful to his wife, that's kind of who he was, and we were still willing to vote for him. So we can't necessarily, you know, we're not necessarily shocked or care about these payments to mistresses to keep them quiet. But I think when we maybe perhaps find out the extent to what his business dealings were like, I don't know. I think perhaps it'll be a little bit different.
You think so, Sherry?
I have to think that, Dan.
You have to think that. If Mueller comes up with a report showing obstruction of justice, that's going to be really interesting. And if you have a Democratic Congress or Democratic House, at least by January, it's going to be a really interesting year ahead.
I mean, I think it certainly will strain the bonds that he has with some people, but they've overlooked a lot. Obstruction of justice is a fairly abstract crime, so I'm not sure how much they'll identify with that. If the economy tanks, and that's not a crazy hypothetical. There are many economists who are beginning to look for something like that. If they get hit in their pocketbooks and begin to see that they don't have the health coverage that they used to have, or that the jobs didn't come back, I think that might.
Or they see how much it costs now to buy a car. Car loans have gone up tremendously, like the cost of that. So
because
we
tariffs,
kind of kept this artificially, you know, I think this high in terms of interest rates and things like that is starting to really kind of creep up at a pretty fast clip. And so I think that's going to put the brakes on the economic growth here.
And also, one other thing. I noticed this week a poll on how Americans view the tax cuts that went through in December. Republicans are counting on that to soften the blow of what they expect to be happening in the midterm elections, that people are going to see more money in their pocketbooks. They're getting some people are getting bonuses. But Americans are not fooled by that, because the polls show that they take a very sour view toward the tax cuts. They don't expect to see much of it in their own pocketbooks and understand that the majority of it is going to go to wealthy people, to stock buybacks, and to overseas investors. So anyway, thank you very much. We're not really sure what's going to happen here, but that's the Trump era, right? We don't know from hour to hour, actually.
We should have stopped on Melissa's up note.
Yeah. Yes, we should. Sherry, thank you.
Exactly.
And Melissa, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, Dan. Anytime. Bye-bye.
Melissa Deckman is chair of the Political Science Department at Washington College, a regular contributor to Roughly Speaking, and the author of Tea Party Women, Mama Grizzlies, Grassroots Leaders, and the Changing Face of the American Right. Sherry Parks is our American culture commentator, associate dean at the University of Maryland, and starting in June, she'll be taking on a new job as vice president for strategic initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Congratulations to Sherry on her new position here in Baltimore. And that's our show for today. Your thoughts are always welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please review our show on iTunes if you get the chance. For the producers, Steve Early and Queen Kelly in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966. Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes David Linden, Johns Hopkins Professor of Neuroscience and editor of Think Tank, a cutting-edge collection of essays exploring the quirky and counterintuitive aspects of the brain. Linden will be joined by colleagues Dr. Connor and Dr. Bastian. Wednesday, April 25th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop at 6080 Falls Road. For more information, call 410-377-2966 or go to theivybookshop.com. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.
Good day from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 376. 376 episodes so far. Wow. For Thursday, April 19th, 2018. On the show today, evangelicals and Donald Trump. How the Christian right has made a deal to overlook a lot of issues related to Trump's character and to support him, no matter what. No matter porn star, playmate, nasty tweets, or arguably anti-Christian tax cuts for the rich. According to Newsweek, a new poll suggests that Trump's base of white evangelical support has not been hurt at all by his lawyer's hush money to Stormy Daniels, nor by the allegations that Trump had a year-long affair with a former Playboy bunny shortly after his wife Melania gave birth to their son Barron. Au contraire, as reports of the president's infidelities and shady business deals have piled up, says Newsweek, white evangelical Protestants have only come to hold more favorable attitudes about the guy. In October, 73% of white evangelicals supported Trump. Now, according to a new poll from the Public Religion Research Institute, support has risen a couple of percentage points to 75%. Why? And is this hypocritical? Joining me today for this discussion about conservative Christians seeing Trump as their man no matter what are American culture commentator Sherry Parks and political analyst Melissa Deckman.
I saw a tweet the other day from Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, lauding Donald Trump for being a pious, prayerful man and saying that he was praying for Donald Trump.
I pray for the president, and I'm proud that he's our president and that he solicits prayer, wants it, and understands it. It's refreshing to have someone like that in power.
And I know he said other nice things about Donald Trump being a religious man.
Well, you know, the president has not been ashamed of the name of Jesus Christ. He hasn't been ashamed of his faith. And that's refreshing. He doesn't mind pastors like myself mentioning the name of Jesus Christ. And President Trump, some people have questioned his faith. I'm not going to question his faith. He says he's a Christian, so I have to believe him and trust him. But he is a man who does want God's help. And he wants God's help, not only in the presidency, but as he deals with all the world problems and problems here at home, he wants God's help.
And I've read some other evangelicals who've said this, and I'm just kind of amazed by that, given all that's happened, all that's been revealed either during the campaign or since then, especially when it comes to how he's treated women and how he's behaved. This is also counterintuitive to me, and you look at polling, Melissa, you have... There's a new poll out being reported by Newsweek today that shows like 75% support among evangelicals.
Among white evangelicals.
Among white evangelicals.
It is kind of head-scratching, I think. I would say a couple things. One, I think that white evangelicals are not entirely monolithic, and there are certainly evangelicals out there who have been consistently opposed to Donald Trump because of his background, because of his immoral acts and his personal life. And so there is a voice of criticism there. The problem, though, is when you have someone who's as notable as Franklin Graham, who has a big following, or someone like Tony Perkins from the Family Research Council, which is a leading Christian right organization, who says the president deserves a mulligan for having had an affair with a porn star. Those voices tend to rise to the top, and they're obviously quite hypocritical at best. It's one thing to, I think, be more transactional, to recognize that Trump is a flawed person, but many evangelical leaders have been happy with Trump in terms of his policies and his procedures. So he's appointed pro-life judges. He's walked back some transgender rights. He moved the capital of Israel to Jerusalem. All of these issues are really important to many Christian right leaders. And so I think there has been a willingness to support Trump because of the actions he's had in office. I think what's harder to swallow is when you have evangelical leaders like Franklin Graham who are saying that somehow he's personally, while in office, become more pious and he's a man of faith. I think that's harder to reconcile with a lot of people. And so for many people who look at this devout support, this unwavering support among white evangelicals, I think something like 78% of them say he's doing a good job. That's where the disconnect comes in for people who aren't necessarily affiliated with the movement.
It's really interesting to go back a little bit with the idea of the mulligan, because I've been thinking about the idea of Christian forgiveness, and I'm not sure that I've ever heard a doctrine that talks about forgiveness if you've never repented and you keep doing it.
Yes, doesn't there have to be some sincerity there? I am heartily sorry. I'm sincerely sorry.
Right. And I mean, and certainly I've heard, certainly in Protestant circles, that, you know, you're already forgiven. But, you know, when you can not confess, because they don't have confession in that way, but that God has already forgiven you before you know it. But this idea of a mulligan suggests you get to do it over and over and over again. And then it's a do over. Yeah. It's a golf term. And so it's really kind of interesting. There's this whole new aspect of, I really think that the religious leaders are covering themselves so that they can praise Trump and still have their authority, because they have to say, well, no, he's really a good man. Really, I've conceptualized this mulligan aspect.
Because they get what they want.
Exactly.
As Melissa just described.
Well, I mean, it reminds me of, there have been other times in American history where expedience was more important than the moral high ground. And this is an expedient moment. One of the things about the New York Times article that you mentioned, it described how the evangelical right, the white evangelical right, has gotten smaller and smaller. And we still see that in the Newsweek article that Melissa identified, is that only 8% of their membership is under 30. So you're getting a smaller, more isolated, more to the right, more male group of people. It's that angry white male aspect that we've been talking about for a long time. And Trump is their guy. And so we certainly see this in political behavior as a type of consumer behavior, unfortunately, where, I mean, you buy the thing and then you make up a rationale for why you buy it.
I agree completely with Sherry. There's a lot of what I would call post hoc theological rationalization going on. And I also agree with Sherry, too, that a lot of these religious figures have to sort of justify, you know, why they're still backing this guy, given his personal behavior that is just entirely repugnant. But, you know, a lot of the people in their pews are big Trump backers, frankly, and so that they have to kind of recognize that a lot of the people that are sitting in their pews are supportive. But getting back to this post hoc theological rationalization, all of a sudden, for example, I see lots of stories on Christian right websites about King David. You know, King David was flawed. He had a man killed on the battlefront so he could marry Bathsheba, right? So there's like pointing to this, like, and still God used King David for good ends. And that's kind of what you get a lot of these Christian right leaders saying. Well, Trump, of course, is flawed. We're all flawed. God forgives us, but he can still be used for good ends. You know, the ends justifies the means, which is really, frankly, a very unchristian, I would say, argument, but nonetheless, one that you hear a lot in some circles among evangelical leaders.
Well, and if you tie that with his very apparent lack of knowledge of scripture, any scripture, then what does that make him? I'm not suggesting that anybody who is perceived as an instrument of God is what we would call a dumb instrument in computer science. But that suggests that he is. He doesn't know the scripture. He doesn't understand it. He's not living the life. And yet God uses him, makes him basically this instrument, this tool.
Mm-hmm. In the minds of these
right.
evangelicals. I want to go back to forgiveness for a moment. This idea that we're all sinners. Yeah, okay, I'll accept that, but you have to ask for forgiveness. There has to be, I used the word sincerity before. You don't get any of that from Trump. Remember Jimmy Carter, President Carter's deep inner thoughts that he shared in public, I think in a Playboy magazine interview.
Lusting in his heart.
But, you know, he was a religious man, deeply steeped in his faith, and talked a lot about, you know, forgiveness and being a sinner and hoping to find redemption someplace, you know. That's not part of Trump's vocabulary at all.
No, and in fact, during the campaign, during the presidential campaign, he was asked point blank whether he'd ask God for forgiveness. He's like, I don't really have anything to ask for forgiveness for. That really was his response. So, wow. Which is just mind-boggling to think, you know, that evangelical leaders are feel the need, many on the right at least, feel the need to sort of justify, you know, and claim that he's had this spiritual growth while in office. And clearly his behavior has not changed at all. He still lies with impunity. You know, he still uses tweets to malign people and to call them names, and is passing policies socially that might be conservative, but in terms of, if you think about the Beatitudes and the gospel message, you know, passing huge tax cuts for the wealthiest people is not exactly what I would call a Christian sort of doctrine.
Yeah, and treatment of the least of these is not what's going on. Yeah.
Connie Morella served in Congress from Maryland for 8 terms. She was a Republican from Montgomery County. She was on the show last week, and she used that term tribalism. So I go to this term now because I think when you look at Trump's 40% approval rating that seems to be unchanged, right? It's not dropping. It's not getting much better either, but it's around that 40% mark pretty solidly. I think maybe we are at a place where this is our guy, and no matter what, we're sticking with him. And if you people on the left, the Democrats don't like him, then he must be good, or something like that.
And we'll follow him into battle. If you follow that, we'll follow him into battle.
Oh, yeah.
No matter what.
If it's a tribe, yeah. What about tribalism? I mean, maybe that's another term for super partisanship.
Or nativism.
Yeah, well, that's part of that tribe's thing, right? Mm-hmm. So I was struck by that term. I said, maybe that's where we are. Maybe that's what this is about.
I would agree, Dan. I mean, as a political scientist, I can tell you we've looked a lot at growing partisan polarization in American politics, and there is a tribal aspect to that. So, in fact, you're willing to justify or overlook certain behaviors if the person has an R behind his name. I mean, a great example of this would be last December's special election in Alabama with Roy Moore. I mean, to me, I just was left speechless that Donald Trump would attend a rally in support of someone like Roy Moore, who, you know, of course, credibly, there was credible evidence that he had sexually assaulted minors. You know, you think to yourself, there has to be a line in the sand, right? But apparently not. And so that, to me, kind of is just the most blatant example of the problems with tribalism. But I think it's also, again, partisanship colors so much of our views in the American public. So I just wanted to give you a great example. This is one of my favorite questions that PRRI has asked in the last couple of years about personal morality. And so they've asked consistently American voters, do you think an elected official who commits an immoral act in their private life can still behave ethically in public life, right? If you asked this to white evangelicals in 2011, only 30% of white evangelicals agreed with that comment there. So for them, personal morality really counted. However, when asked during the context of the presidential campaign, 72% said that they believe that you can be immoral in your personal life and still behave ethically in public life. 42 percentage points. And so, I mean, if you ask that question during the Clinton administration, you'd have a very different answer because of the nature of our politics today.
Or Obama. The question was asked while Obama was president, right?
That was asked first asked right when Obama was president.
That's
but I think back to what
amazing.
These same leaders were saying with respect, for example, to the Lewinsky affair that President Clinton had, you know, in the late 90s.
Well, when you start comparing them to other presidents, that's why I was fascinated by the word mulligan, because during his tenure, Clinton asked for a mulligan in golf. It was written about as an indication of his moral problems.
Yes, that was a great article.
That?
I did read that.
And now we're talking about a much different mulligan, and you get it. They're giving him permission. But I really do think that this is, I mean, you brought up tribalism and nativism, that at this point, many people in that camp don't care. They're worried about the browning of America. They're worried about all of these aspects. And that type of behavior isn't necessarily rational. I mean, they are trying to preserve a certain way of life, and they don't care as long as they deliver it. There are many times, we're talking about religiosity, but many times he says things that just aren't true. The whole comment about Nigeria and huts.
Yeah.
The Nigerians are the most highly educated immigrants, not most highly educated black immigrants, most highly educated immigrants that come to the United States. So it's just blatantly not true. And yet people follow his dictate. And I said this many, many years ago. I mean, not many, but 2015. This model really isn't about rationality. It really is about irrationality.
Yeah, because I don't know how else you explain it. It must be based on these visceral reactions people have to, as you say, more immigrants coming into the country. They're concerned about that. You know, women moving into positions of power.
Getting some.
You know, and look at the reaction to these kids in Florida on gun control. Really angry, nasty response from the right toward
survivors.
You know, survivors of a trauma. I mean, it's just amazing to me. I guess that speaks to the tribalism, too, that's out there. So David Brooks had a column in the Times last week, I think it was, saying that the resistance isn't working. You're not breaking through to people who are still supporting Trump. Look at his support among Republicans. Generally, it's still, what, Melissa, 70 or higher?
Yeah, it hasn't really budged at all.
Yeah.
It hasn't.
So he's saying, you know, that's a reelection to me in 2020. The resistance isn't working because the people who are resisting fail to recognize what's eating people who are supporting Trump, why they're supporting Trump. And I don't know that you can break through, given what we're talking about here.
And the changes that they are resisting from the right are irreversible. I mean, Latinos are having, the ones who are here, we're not talking about immigration, are are younger and they're having more babies. And so the browning of America will continue. Women are the majority in the workforce and in colleges. So that trend will continue.
Right.
So these are irreversible trends no matter what they do, and they're going to be angry about it.
You know, I think that all of these things are really true. And what was brilliant about Trump's campaign message, Make America Great Again, it was the again part, because essentially this kind of tapped into a lot of voters' insecurities about changes in the economy that they weren't really feeling. The browning of America, as Sherry points out, women getting, I think, more leadership roles, taking over jobs than maybe that men had. And so I think that all of those things are very true. But, you know, it's a short-term gain, but in the long term, this is going to do substantial damage to the Republican Party, frankly.
In what way? Tell me what you see happening there. We just heard of another Republican congressman yesterday or this week announcing that he wasn't going to be seeking re-election, of course, Paul Ryan. So what do you see happening there, Melissa?
Essentially, the Republican Party has now become the party of Trump. And if you look at younger Americans, as Sherry's already alluded to, I mean, they are becoming far more alienated from that party. I was doing some data analysis on a survey that MTV did with PRRI that came out in late January. And it was striking because what I found is that, first of all, only about 20% of millennials believe that Trump is doing a good job. But what I also found was that young women in particular were far more likely to be animated and engaged in the political process. And so the young women who were most engaged were ones who were identifying as Democrats, who backed Hillary Clinton in the last campaign, and who prioritized gender equality. And so the backlash that Trump has caused, I think, for a lot of these groups, and when you think about political identity forming in adolescence and forming in early adulthood, I mean, it's rare that people change their parties over time. And so you have this new generation of younger, more diverse, and more progressive folks coming up. And the Republican Party is completely just, I think, alienating those voters.
They're going to run out of people. So if you look at the average age of the Trump supporter, you're talking about people who statistically are going to die, I mean, to be blunt, in the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're just going to run out of people.
Connie Morella, to quote her again, pointed out that there weren't enough women moving into position to run for office this year who are Republican. She looked at the charts that came out from the, I think it's Rutgers that keeps track of this. The Institute at Rutgers that keeps track of the number of women who have filed papers to be candidates for Congress this year and in state offices, all of them. And, you know, I think 2/3 are Democrats. So I said, is that because of Trump? And she said, yeah, she thinks it's because of Trump that there's a turnoff for young women.
I don't think it's even just because of Trump. That's part of it. And in fact, it's even more lopsided than 2/3. I think it's like 70. Oh, it's almost 3-1.
Is it really?
these record-breaking number of women running, they're far more likely to be Democrats. It's also because the GOP has just not been very welcoming to women at all. So, for example, the Democratic Party prioritizes diversity, but they've also put lots of money where their mouth is, so to speak. I mean, they have got lots of candidate training. They provide seed money for women. They have candidate training schools. But there's virtually no money being spent by the Republican Party to try to encourage and recruit women to run for office at all. It just simply isn't a priority. In fact, polling data shows when you asked average American voters, do you think it's more important to have more women elected to office? Democrats, like 80%, say yes. Only about 40% of Republicans say yes. And even Republican women don't think it's more important to have more women in office. And so I think that Connie Morell is right. Like, Trump has definitely caused this surge of women on the left. But at the same time, you know, you don't necessarily have lots of Republican women saying, I should be running for office myself.
Because that runs counter to the message of the Republican religious right. I mean, there really is still a message about women being subservient and submissive. And so, I mean, the politics has always been kind of dirty, aggressive business. It's gotten dirtier and more aggressive. And that doesn't fit well with what the religious right says about women's roles.
It's also, too, though, that women who run for office, say, in primaries among the GOP, are often penalized for being women in the sense that voters think that women that run in GOP primaries tend to be more moderate as opposed to conservative. And the base right now rewards the most conservative people running for office. And so women have faced sort of a penalty, I think, there. You know, I thought it was going to go a very different route, to be perfectly honest. You know, I've always been fascinated by Sarah Palin and her impact on American politics. In fact, I wrote a book about Tea Party women. And it looked, at least for a brief time, that you had a surge of interest among Republican women who were willing to put their hats in the ring to be more involved in politics. But with this administration, with Trump, that seems to have died down dramatically, really.
Palin was a difficult model to follow. I mean, with her Alaska big game hunting aspect, I mean, there was a type of masculinization of her image.
Oh, absolutely.
Interesting perception of her. Yeah, that's true. There's a long list of things that people in the Trump base, that 40% or 39% that's holding, are willing to overlook. It's a long list. We mentioned several of them here today in this context of morality, right? But also policy issues, or possible policy issues. His approach toward Russia, for instance, you know, pulling sanctions the other day against Russian companies that have been found to collude with Syria on chemical weapons productions, right? Something like that is pretty serious stuff. And also the whole question of, was there collusion in the between the Trump campaign and Russian operatives to help him get elected? The people on the right seem to be dismissive of that. Now I'm hearing more and more criticism of James Comey, who's on a book tour now, talking about his relationship with Trump. And I find this really counterintuitive. I just want to share this with you for a moment. The most conservative people are pro-cop, Blue Lives Matter people, right? I get mail from them, and I hear them on talk radio all the time. So they seem to be pro-law enforcement, pro-law and order, and they're not even entertaining the question of whether Trump obstructed justice, the Trump campaign colluded with a rival power to win an election. So dismissive of that. I'm struck by that. I still find it somewhat amazing in the time when so many things are amazing. I just find that particular thing amazing. Lack of respect for people who have been career in law enforcement, either as prosecutors or as investigators, FBI agents. Look at how the FBI is being criticized.
You know, Dan, though, you have to also consider where they're getting their news and information.
Absolutely.
Most of these people are watching Fox News, and Fox News paint stories in such a way that essentially minimize or accuse, you know, the FBI. I did watch Sean Hannity the other night, because I do watch Fox News just to kind of get a gauge of what is being said and the messages that are being sent. And it's usually lots of immigrants who are committing crimes. That's kind of the drumbeat. But they've taken, you know, especially Sean Hannity has taken to really maligning even someone who's almost universally respected, someone like Robert Mueller. At one point, he had like a diagram basically saying the Mueller crime family, right? Basically saying he was colluding with Clinton and all this other nonsense, which there's no, of course, verifiable fact. But, I mean, studies show that people on the far right, that's all they listen to Fox, they listen to Rush Limbaugh, they're reading websites that allow them to live in echo chambers where they're only hearing one perspective of things. And so this has allowed them to really minimize and to call into question as fake news what these special counsels and other investigations are doing. So they just don't believe it, because they've been primed not to believe it by people on the far right.
And I agree with that. I think we're also at the maybe not the end, but certainly on a continuum, because if you think about this transition from traditional Christianity to what we have now, the electronic church plays a role. So that most of those electronic pastors were on the right. Fundamentalism became the term.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of getting your religion from the TV, it was really an aspect. And so one of the things that has been suggested is that Fox News has replaced Christian doctrine in the emotional lives of the faithful. Mm. And so the idea of getting it straight from the TV, even when it's not a pastor, I think that was a 20-year continuum, but you can begin to see people giving, I mean, you have to talk about faith when you're talking about reporting that flies in the face of mainstream media.
There's evidence that what you're saying is completely true. Just last week or the week before, Politico came out with an analysis of news subscriptions in areas where Trump did better than Romney. Did you see that, Melissa?
I have not, I want to hear what they found.
This is fascinating. So they found actually news deserts, what they called news deserts, where there was a low news subscription rate, meaning people read newspapers or subscribed to some sort of digital bona fide news service, you know, like Reuters or Yahoo News or something like that. the New York Times, Washington Post, or the local newspaper. And it's very low in places where Trump performed better than Romney in the 2016 election. So you're right. So what fills that gap? It's what's on the television, right? And a lot of times it's Fox News. What we're saying then, basically, at this juncture in 2018, as we're headed into the midterms in a few months, is that maybe nothing can break through to that supportive base of Trump. That sounds it sounds like that's what we're saying, and not just among evangelicals.
In some respects, but I think there's two other points, though, that I would say. One is that I think the economy is doing fairly well, sort of inexplicably in some ways. When you look at some, like the stock market, it's just head-scratching as to why these companies are overvalued and that sort of thing. So I think, you know, we are political junkies, and we're inundated, and we read this stuff all the time, and a lot of Americans simply don't. They kind of tune out, and they think, well, things are okay for me. He's not really doing it. The president maybe isn't necessarily doing as bad of a job. I think if the economy tanks in the next couple of years, there'll be more pressure, I think, and you'll see some loss of support. I think the other thing, too, and what I've been finding interesting, is with this news about Michael Cohen, and we're going to learn a lot more about Trump's business dealings, I have a feeling, maybe the unsavory aspects of that. And so I suspect that might turn some people away from Donald Trump, but not all of them. I mean, they've been willing to stick it out this far, giving all of this other information. I mean, I think some people would say, well, look, with Donald Trump, that was sort of baked in the cake. We kind of knew he was unfaithful to his wife, that that's kind of who he was, and we were still willing to vote for him. So we can't necessarily, you know, we're not necessarily shocked or care about these payments to mistresses to keep them quiet. But I think when we maybe perhaps find out the extent to what his business dealings were like, I don't know. I think perhaps it's a little bit, it'll be a little bit different.
You think so, Sherry?
I have to think that, Dan.
You have to think that. If Mueller comes up with a report showing obstruction of justice, that's going to be really interesting. And if you have a Democratic Congress, or Democratic House, at least, by January, it's going to be a really interesting year ahead.
I mean, I think it certainly will strain the bonds that he has with some people, but they've overlooked a lot. Obstruction of justice is a fairly abstract crime, so I'm not sure how much they'll identify with that. If the economy tanks, and that's not a crazy hypothetical. There are many economists who are beginning to look for something like that. If they get hit in their pocketbooks and begin to see that they don't have the health coverage that they used to have, or that the jobs didn't come back, I think that might.
Or they see how much it costs now to buy a car. Car loans have gone up tremendously, the cost of that. So
because
we
tariffs,
kind of kept this artificially, you know, I think this high in terms of interest rates and things like that is starting to really kind of creep up at a pretty fast clip. And so I think that's going to put the brakes on on economic growth here.
And also, one other thing. I noticed this week a poll on how Americans view the tax cuts that went through in December. Republicans are counting on that to soften the blow of what they expect to be happening in the midterm elections, that people are going to see more money in their pocketbooks. They're getting some people are getting bonuses. But Americans are not fooled by that, because the polls show that they take a very sour view toward the tax cuts. They don't expect to see much of it in their own pocketbooks, and understand that the majority of it is going to go to the wealthy people, to stock buybacks, and to overseas investors. So anyway, thank you very much. We're not really sure what's going to happen here, but that's the Trump era, right? We don't know from hour to hour, actually.
We should have stopped on Melissa's up note.
Yeah. Yes, we should. Sherry, thank you.
Exactly.
And Melissa, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, Dan. Anytime. Bye-bye.
Melissa Deckman is chair of the Political Science Department at Washington College, a regular contributor to Roughly Speaking, and the author of Tea Party Women, Mama Grizzlies, Grassroots Leaders, and the Changing Face of the American Right. Sherry Parks is our American culture commentator, associate dean at the University of Maryland, and starting in June, she'll be taking on a new job as vice president for strategic initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Congratulations to Sherry on her new position here in Baltimore. And that's our show for today. Your thoughts are always welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please review our show on iTunes if you get the chance. For the producers, Steve Early and Queen Kelly in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.